Hello and howdy and welcome to the Gardening Network Show. Today we'll be discussing whether to seed or not to seed. Yes, this is our question today. We have a very special guest today, Stephen Scott. He and his wife Cindy are seed experts and own and manage, I hope I pronounce this correctly, Terror Seed Company out of Arizona. And they can be found at underwoodgardens.com. And you're joining your host for the day, Siobhan Shaw from beautiful and high Canada. And our Donna Butler, sweet Donna Butler from luscious Louisiana, is in the dental chair right now. So we're wishing her all the best, and we'll see her at our next show. And then, of course, me, Lisa Roberts from pretty Central Texas. The Gardening Network Show is sponsored by Little Crop Circles, where you can grow in more in small spaces. Find Little Crop Circles at littlecropcircles.com. And hello, Siobhan and Stephen. How are y'all today?
Very good.
Hey, Stephen. I'm really good. It's very hot here. We live in a orchard winery community, and it's very, very hot right now, but it just means everything is flourishing. We're picking apricots and cherries right now, and they say that the peaches are going to be early this year, and we've just had amazing weather up here.
So what's hot for you?
Oh, like 95 to 100.
Wow, okay. That's what we're at here in Central Arizona, so... I would imagine that is quite warm for you.
Yeah, we have to come out of our igloos.
especially. Well, it's always that hot here in Texas, so we're used to that.
Right,
and humid.
Right.
Is it humid?
Oh, yes, very, very humid. Stephen, I wanted to ask you, I love the name of your company. What does, am I saying that correctly, Terror?
Yes, you are really, really close on that. Depends on if you're French or not.
No.
Terroir means soil. Direct translation from French means soil, but as with most things French, there's a whole lot more to it. And the deeper definition means the connection between where something is grown and the taste of that particular place due to its unique, is what we call microclimate. The soil, the minerals in the soil, the minerals in the water, the amount of sun, the amount of shade, how rich the soil is or poor the soil is. And it's really a response, the instinctual recognition that we have that a carrot that's grown in Canada and a carrot that's grown in Central Texas and a carrot that's grown in Central Arizona should taste differently. And we have kind of the McDonald's approach. And, you know, that model has been very successful, that a burger tastes the same no matter where, in the U.S. you go. But inherently we recognize that as not true agriculture.
That's true.
Grow a carrot in sandy soil, grow it in rich soil, even if it's the same packet the same day, it's going to taste completely different. And so part of why we chose that as a company name is,
I love it,
we have spent, we were fortunate enough to get to know some local ranchers and work with them in rangeland and habitat restoration. And it all comes back to the soil, whether it's in your home garden, whether it's a pot of herbs on the windowsill, or it's a 10,000-acre ranch, it all comes down to the soil. It's kind of funny when we start talking about pests or diseases or insect pressures or flavors, it really all comes back to the fertility of the soil. And so looking back, it was, what do we bring to the table that's unique? And
right.
That was our experiences in And literally, we'd be out on the ranch with the you know, going through and looking at things and looking at experiments and looking at successes and failures. And then I would bring that back to my home garden and try to duplicate that on a smaller scale.
How wonderful. And I love the name. That just encompasses everything.
Well, and it's when we first started, we were a little concerned because it is unique. And people couldn't pronounce it, and we would get mixed up with, other seed companies. But now I think we've been around a while. We're just finishing our seventh year, and people kind of remember it's that tear something, you know. But they know us for our uniqueness because of all the education that we do.
Can you tell us a little bit about your company and about the education that y'all do with seeds?
Yes. Our motto is from the soil to the seed to the food you eat. When we were first starting the company, there's some fantastic seed companies out there. There's some less than fantastic seed companies out there as well. As with any industry, there's good and there's not so good. And when we were looking at it, it's, well, what do we bring to the table? Why would anybody want to do business with us? What's unique about us? And
yeah.
I've been very interested in cooking for a long time. And so when we started looking at all of this, and it's soil, and it's the experience with the soil, it's improving the soil, it's, you know, these kind of things, and then you have the seed, and then you have the cooking and the drying and the dehydrating and the canning and the seed saving components. That's really what makes us unique I'm not going to say that there are no other companies that do what we do, but I think there's very, very few that do what we do. We really look at the holistic approach. Because when we looked at this in 2007, 2008, there were some really good seed companies, and then you'd go elsewhere to get gardening information, and then you'd go elsewhere to find out what to do with that 100 pounds of tomatoes, you know, out of your garden. And it just made sense to us to kind of have a lot of this information in one place. And, mm-hmm. you know, we're not the be-all and end-all of all of the information, but we talk from our experiences and try to share what we found to be successful and what we found not to be successful. So that's, you know, that's what we bring to the gardening world.
Wow. I just have so many questions, Siobhan. I'm going to let you go first, though, Siobhan.
Thank you. I'm doing social media at the same time, so if you hear me typing, it's because I'm telling people what you're just telling us. And I love this concept that the same seed from the same plant grown in different microclimates can taste differently. I never, ever gave that any thought.
And it's one that tells me you're not a wine drinker. Or not.
No,
wait,
no, I am.
She does like wine.
And the reason I say that is one of the things that really kind of pointed out to me was we have a friend who kind of helped start the wine movement in Arizona. And the first few years when he had his vineyard in, you know, of course, his vineyard's not producing grapes. So he had apprenticed in California, and he had several really good friends in California that he was importing his grapes from. And he did a wine tasting of a single type of grape, a single type of wine, but they were all within, I'd say, 20 miles of each other.
Hmm.
And some of the grapes literally were 2 miles apart of, you know, the different wines.
Yeah.
And he did a tasting, and this wasn't, you know, a group of wine connoisseurs with highly trained palates. This was everyday folks that kind of liked wine. And he would talk about different varieties and, you know, where they were grown and southern aspect or more northern aspect or more clay, more, you know, more limestone, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you could taste the differences in the wine. And they were very clear, very distinct differences.
Wow.
Some of them were a little more nuanced. And you're like, well, it's, you know, that's really similar. Oh, but I'm kind of getting this here and I'm getting that there. And these, like I said, I enjoy the occasional glass of wine, but I am not a sommelier by any means. And it's easy to pick this out. And so when you take that to food, wow.
Wow, is right.
You know, and chefs are really starting to pick up on this. You know, Dan Barber and Rick Bayless and, you know, Alice Waters has picked up on this for, you know, 30, 40 years. So, you know, it's a concept that is not new, but is kind of coming back around, and it's exciting to see.
Now, here's something exciting I read about today on Wikipedia as I was researching seeds, because I've only ever just planted seeds. I never gave them a second thought. I just, you know, a seed is a seed, and it's going to grow a plant, and I'm going to get to eat great fresh vegetables from it, right?
Right, right.
So I read on Wikipedia there was actually different categories of seeds, and this is the fun part for our listeners. There's enclosed seeds, and then there's naked seeds. what's the difference?
Let's back up just one more step and talk about heirloom, open pollinated, those sort of things, and then we'll get into what you're talking about. An heirloom is something, it's not just a seed, it's something that's been handed down generation to generation. So grandmother's heirloom china, her heirloom silver, you know, granddad's heirloom fly fishing collection, you know, this kind of thing. And it's the same thing with seeds. You know, when you track the travels of tomatoes, you know, they originated in Central America. So if you were to go to Italy prior to about 1600, you're not going to have pasta sauce because they still thought tomatoes were poisonous. You know, and then the tomatoes traveled all over the world. The same thing with the chilies, you know, and so when, you know, son or daughter would get married or they would move, you know, they would take a packet of, you know, a collection of seeds with them to continue gardening because, you know, up until just post-World War II, there really weren't supermarkets. So most people grew their own food, or most of their own food, or, you know, local farmers, that sort of thing. What most people talk about when they say heirloom, they mean open-pollinated. And an open-pollinated variety is something that you can save seed from year after year after year because it's going to grow true to what you save seed from.
Right.
Hybrids are... Well, every person is a hybrid. You know, we're part of mom, we're part of dad. We're not, you know, either one of them, sometimes to the chagrin of one or the other. And you know, our kids are not 100% us. And so hybrids are, you know, if you're talking a hybrid tomato, it's a mix of tomato A and tomato B. Hybrids have their place. They tend to be very good in production, and you can count on so many pounds of tomatoes in a certain amount of time. Whereas heirlooms came from the home garden, and so on a larger scale, heirlooms are not really good for, you know, providing 1,000 pounds of tomatoes to the farmer's market or the cannery or that sort of thing every Saturday. Now, part of the problem with hybrids is the pendulum has swung so far that you have Florida plant tomato breeders who openly admit that flavor is nowhere on their chart of what they look for. They're looking for early, even ripening, resistance or tolerance to shipping. You know, they list all these characteristics and flavors nowhere in there. Okay, so this is where we get our beloved cardboard supermarket tomato.
Yes.
Versus the heirloom that's delicate and fragile and barely makes it into the kitchen. You know, but the flavor's
so
amazing.
Juicy.
So, right, right. Well, you know, they're not, you know, with the heirlooms, nobody thinks about, I need to ship this 1,000 miles. You know,
You're right.
I need to carry it into the kitchen kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So hybrids are not GMOs. Genetic modified organism is that tomato or corn that has a foreign gene inserted into it, a bacteria, a virus, you know, a fish gene, a frog gene, whatever. And so those are completely different. You know, there's a lot of hype and fear on both sides of the fence with the GMO issue. We choose to work only with open pollinated varieties. And mostly heirlooms. So we work with most of the older varieties, and the reason we choose to do this is because they have the flavor. They have the proven track record. black Krim tomato from the island of Krim in Ukraine, southern Russia, is like Phoenix in the summertime. It's 105 degrees there, 110 degrees. And this is a tomato that has traveled there and been grown and saved and selected for, you know, a couple hundred years. And obviously it performs well in a harsh climate, and it has a flavor that people want to continue to keep around. And so when you look at heirlooms, we are on the receiving end of sometimes hundreds, sometimes thousands of years of seed saving and selection, you know, choosing the best. And that's why we choose to work with those. Now, to your question, naked versus, you know, regular seed, naked seeds are like the Styrian hullus pumpkin seed. Or the what is called Lady Godiva is another variety because it's naked, you know, like Lady Godiva.
Like Lady Godiva.
Okay.
See?
So they
will add a little excitement to everybody's life here today.
Exactly. Especially on a Monday. They don't have a hull around the seed. So the Styrian hullus pumpkin and the Lady Godiva pumpkin seeds make a wonderful snack because you don't have to shell them. Now, the challenge is you have to have the perfect conditions when you plant them because they don't have that hull to protect and kind of hold them if the conditions aren't perfect for growing. Go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt. Is that why, if they're not protected by the hull, is that why often sometimes you find that seeds basically rot in the ground?
Well, hullus seeds are kind of rare. That's a mutation, kind of a random sort of thing. And in Styria, in the 1950s, it's a province in Austria. They discovered these seeds, and they were like, "Wow, this is kind of cool. Let's play with this. Let's develop this a little bit more." Most seeds have that hull or that shell around them. You know, your tomato seeds, your pepper seeds. You know. Most pumpkin seeds, you know, in fact, almost every seed that you're going to work with has that hull. And what that does is it protects the seed as it dries to give it a longer lifespan. Mm-hmm. And once it goes into the ground, the hull absorbs the moisture and kind of starts that whole germination process. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing is, you know, let's say you plant it and it's really nice. It's a perfect conditions, but, you know, this weekend we get a heavy rainstorm and all of a sudden now it's waterlogged, it's too cold. Well, that hull just kind of puts a hold on everything. And so it allows the soil to dry out, things to warm back up, and then it'll start germination again. Whereas with the naked seed, it's going to rot because it's only got, you know, 3 to 5 days to really get things going. So it's a little more chancy with that.
Stephen, what is the oldest seed that y'all have?
Those would be some of the herbs and flowers. Mm. Some of the herbs predate Christianity.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, and they're common. It's like sage. You know, sage is an incredibly old herb.
How do they know that?
For a second.
How do they date seeds?
The Greeks and Romans had some kind of rudimentary cookbooks, and they would talk about certain herbs. A lot of the vegetables that we're familiar with today didn't exist in the same form 1,000, 2,000 years ago. Some of them did, but not as much. But we get a lot of our culinary record from the herbs. And, you know, the vegetables that the Romans cooked with, a lot of those don't exist anymore. Taste change, preferences change, you know, agriculture changes. Something's easier to grow, so something that's more difficult or doesn't produce as much kind of gets pushed to the side. And if it's not kept alive, then goes extinct. So herbs, you know, herbs have flavored wine, you know, they've flavored foods, they've been preservatives, they've been medicinal. So they've had so many different uses in our lives that we've kind of kept the herbs around a lot longer than you know, some of the mm-hmm. some of the more common vegetables.
That is true. If you've joined us today, we have a very special guest, Stephen Scott. He and his wife, Cindy, are seed experts and own and manage Terror Seed Company out of Arizona. And they can be found at underwoodgardens.com. And, of course, we are brought to you, sponsored by Little Crop Circles, where you can grow more in small spaces. And you can find Little Crop Circles at littlecropcircles.com. And I have a quick question for you, too, Stephen. In a nutshell, or seed shell, I should say.
The same thing, isn't it?
It is. What would you say are the pros of planting seeds as opposed to a starter plant?
That's an excellent question. Some seed, like carrots or lettuce or beets, you're only going to basically plant a seed because you're not going to be able to go down to your garden center and get carrot starts or beet starts, that sort of thing. But at the same time, you know, a lot of those things will sprout in 5 days. So, you know, it's easy enough to start from seed. A lot of what you find is starts, tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, that sort of thing, they take a little bit longer to start. Peppers can sometimes take 2 to 3 weeks. And people tend to get, you know, daily life is busy, and sometimes you get kind of caught up in what you're doing, and you forget to water your seedlings, and they die. You know, and so it's easier to go down to the garden center and buy them. But the pros are they're easier to go buy, but your selection is greatly limited. When you're talking tomatoes, it's estimated that there's about 7,500 different heirloom tomato varieties.
Wow.
Okay, so we carry a little over 100.
Wow.
And when you go to the garden center, if you're looking at heirloom tomatoes, they're becoming more common and more popular. You may have 3 or 4 to choose from.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot more selection. And once you've learned and, you know, when you get started starting seeds, you're going to kill a few things, unfortunately. That's part of the process. But once you kind of get started and you learn and you've got some experience, it becomes a lot easier. And then you've got a whole lot more choice and selection of what you want to grow, not just what the garden center has or what the nursery had and was very successful this year.
Correct.
I have a question. It came to my mind when you were talking about the naked seeds, the enclosed seeds, that sort of thing, and the herbs and stuff from Roman times and things like that. Now, is it true that if man didn't plant corn and tend to it, it wouldn't grow naturally?
Correct. Today's corn, even if it's an heirloom corn, corn is a fascinating history, and you know, you become kind of a plant geek, or some people become plant geek as you start looking at the fascinating history on some of this. You know, and other folks are like, I just want to plant my corn and have fresh corn, and that's cool. You know, there's no wrong way about it. But corn is a grass, and at some point in the far distant past, you know, the grass had this mutation that had enlarged kernels, and somebody noticed it and picked it and tasted it and thought, wow, this is cool. And so they planted it, you know, or they kind of scattered the seed, and, you know, we're not quite sure exactly how it happened, but it kind of evolved. But yes, corn definitely evolved with mankind, and even the oldest heirloom corn from Mexico today has to have the human sow its seed. It's not like a tomato. The tomato can drop off, and you know the tomato will rot the next year. You know, you're going to have tomato seeds. Corn, if the corn falls off, most of the time the corn is just going to rot. But if it does make it through the winter, you might have one or two, or you know, a handful of plants out of several hundred seeds. So it's, you know, it has evolved with man for so long, by some estimates, 5,000 years, that it's completely dependent on
us.
Even, you know, not just the Iowa cornfields, but, you know, even the oldest heirloom corn, the indigenous corn, that sort of thing. So, yeah, plants definitely evolve with us. They train us to grow them. not just us as growing, you know, a food. So
it's like my dog who's got me wrapped around her little finger. She's trained me to do tricks.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
Plants,
you know,
are smart.
The corn has rewarded us with abundant food in return for us growing more of it. So, you know, it's a very beneficial relationship on that.
That is interesting. On your, do you know if there are any seed swapping associations where people meet and swap their seeds from different areas?
There's a number of local and regional. It's an excellent question. Probably the first place to look would be your Master Gardener in the U.S., the local Master Gardener Association.
Yes.
It's part of the land-grant universities, and they're pretty much in every county. And in, you know, some of the counties, they're in, you know, three or four different towns. Another resource is Seed Savers Exchange. They're a nonprofit organization out of Iowa, Decorah, Iowa. They have, it's about an inch and a half thick yearbook with the listings of all the individual members who are growing and saving, you know, different varieties. Seed Savers themselves maintains about 600 varieties. It's about the same thing that we have.
Goodness.
They curate about 14 to 1500 varieties, and they estimate that their member-to-member exchange has about 25 to 30,000 varieties.
Wow.
And that's all over the U.S., Canada, and a number of different countries around the world. And it's an independent, you know, you get the yearbook and you say, hey, wow, you know, I've been looking for this, or my granddad had this bean, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You can write to this person and, you know, you would get seed from them, and, you know, then you've got that seed. So it's a, you know, decentralized, independent, member-to-member. And that's probably the largest decentralized, independent seed exchange. But, you know, there's a lot of gardening clubs that do seed exchanges or seed swaps.
True.
So, you know, local, regional, and then, you know, Seed Savers is probably your biggest national, international.
Okay.
So, Stephen, in less than a minute, can you tell people why there is such a large push by these corporations, the big corporations, to control the seeds around the world by patenting them and modifying them?
Henry Kissinger said, if you control the oil, you control the economy. If you control the food, you control the people. Without being conspiracy theorists or the world is ending and that sort of thing, that's a very, very, very hardline business look at it, is if you have intellectual patent rights on the seed that produces the food, you now control the food. Which, when you look at, if you were to look at seed catalogs from 1900 to the seed catalogs in 2000, by some estimates, we've lost 90-plus percent of our seed diversity. Now, some of it was junk that needed to go away, but a lot of it was some really good stuff that was pushed to the margins, wasn't saved, it just went extinct. Having a more diverse seed supply means a more diverse food supply, which means weather patterns, famine, drought, all these kind of things. The seeds are more adaptable to that. So it's a benefit in the long run to have a more diverse supply.
Well, I want to thank you, Stephen Scott, from Chino Valley, Arizona. We'll have to come and visit when we head down there in the winter. You're the owner, with your wife Cindy, of Terroir Seeds in the home of Underwood Gardens. And it's underwoodgardens.com, everybody. Stephen has just been an excellent source of information for us. The show is the Gardening Network is brought to you by littlecropcircles.com. Thank you, Lisa Sellers-Roberts, for all
Thank
the amazing
you.
Stuff you do. Donna, get better. Stephen,
yes.
I hope to see you again.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.